I told her, thank you for signing me to Miss Israel, but not because I'm Miss Israel now, because I got this platform, I got this voice, and I can use that voice now.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
My guest today was Miss Israel of 2021 and represented Israel in Miss Universe 2021. She's a certified pastry chef. She served as an IDF combat medic, an instructor and course commander in the medic course. And she spent over 150 days as a medic in the Gaza war. And I am just in awe of all she's done. And so here I am with, and I need to get your name right. Here I am with Noa Kochva.
Yes.
Kochva as in Bar Kochva.
Exactly.
So you're Bat Kochva.
Hopefully.
Noa, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us, especially in these days. I feel like it's...
Yeah. We just for people, because this episode is going to come out in a few weeks or months, just for people to know, as we're recording this a few days ago, Israel's war with Iran has really took up a new level. We've had awful hits in Israel on civilians and people dead. So it's especially important that you're here and we talk about the things that you've done and are doing. But before we get to that, we're going to start with the question that every guest gets. Noa Kochva.
Yes.
What kind of a Jew are you?
Wow. I feel like over the past 2 years, I'll explain that answer. I'll answer that question with a question for myself, because before October 7th, I wasn't even defining myself. Like, it wasn't even something I was thinking about. I was Israeli, yes, but I was never really asking myself what kind of a Jew I am. And after October 7th, especially after serving almost 6 months in the Gaza border, I've experienced a lot of miracles. And that led me to ask myself that exact question. And why am I Jewish? And why is my grandparents are Jewish? And then it just led me to be a really proud Jew and a vocal one. But more than that, it really brought me closer to God and closer to Judaism. I was never keeping kosher, and I started keeping kosher. I started do everything on Shabbat. I don't keep Shabbat yet, but I'm on my way there. And ever since that happened, I feel like I reconnected with God.
A reconnected Jew.
Yeah.
How do your parents feel about that?
It's funny because my dad was actually very religious when he grew up. And he grew up in yeshiva, in Nechalim, in a very religious moshav. And then when he joined the military, he turned the other way. So when we grew up, we had the holidays and everything. And my dad is still very connected to the holidays and to what being a Jew means. But we weren't really religious. So when I told my dad that I want to keep kosher, he made fun of me and told me, why? Cheeseburger is so good. So my mom is very supportive. She's always been very connected. So it's like, it's a mixed feelings.
So you're a Jew on your way.
Yes, exactly. And
before we get to, you already mentioned your service and everything that happened there. But before that, we need to set the ground for that. You were 18.
Yeah.
What kind of a teenager were you?
So I grew up in a moshav. It's called Moshav Bnei Atarot. And where I grew up, it basically was about the youth movement that we had. So I was a guide there in Bnei Moshavim. It's basically a movement for Moshavim. Moshav is a small village for, I don't know if somebody doesn't know. And that was our life there. This is what we loved doing. We used to go on beautiful trips around Israel, go to see the nature. I was in an AP class, so my life was studying for exams and tried to be the best student that I can. And I feel like I was a big nerd when I was growing up.
And for people that, you know, are listening in and not watching, I really highly recommend that they watch, because obviously you don't look like someone who consider themselves a big nerd, but I'll take you at your word. But you were 18.
Yeah.
And so why did you join the IDF? You could have done everything. You were a nerd. You're a beautiful young woman. You could have done a lot of things. Why enlist?
So first of all, in Israel, as we know, it's a mandatory thing. But more than that, in the house that I was raised, my dad was 40 years in the military. My dad was a pilot, and then he was a squad commander, and then he was the flight school commander. So,
My uncle.
Really?
He was a flight school commander in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. They for sure know each other. So my dad being 40 years in the military, my mom was a psychologist in the military for 16 years, and my entire life was knowing that the military is the best place for you to develop the most... develop really good values and to just become a better person. So I was really waiting to join the military. That's all I was thinking about. And it wasn't really a choice. It was more, to me, it was more of something that I was waiting to do. And also my brothers.
And what made you choose to become a medic?
So the IDF? A little bit more... I'll take you back to when I was 12 years old. So when I was 12 years old, I was diagnosed with a disease named thrombocytopenia. Basically, in Hebrew, I don't know how to say it in English.
I assume it's the same with an accent, right?
Like probably. And I spent around 1 year in a hospital on and off. And then I was diagnosed with several more diseases. And then I was diagnosed with the final diagnosis that I don't have an immune system. So I was born without an immune system. And during my time in the hospital, I saw the nurses, I saw the doctors, and I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. I want to do something that is in that world, because I remember asking them so many questions, and being the big nerd that I am, I loved biology lessons. And to me, the way to keep up on school, because I was obviously not going to school, was basically to learn from my doctors and to ask them random questions that they probably never expected to be asked from a 13 years old girl lying in bed, trying to understand why this is happening to her body. So when I turned 18 and Atzav Shmoneh Sheli Hegia, my...
enlisting, call.
I told my parents that I want to do something in the medical corps of the military. And they asked me, are you sure that's something that you want to do? You've been around that subject basically your entire life. And I told them that that's my time to give back, especially to around anything that is related to medicine. So I remember I saw one role that I really wanted. It was being a combat medic commander and instructor. So I got enlisted and I did my combat medic course. But after 3 months of the training, I realized that I want to teach people. It was like being a teacher. So I went there, and then I did 1 month at the Gaza envelope. I was a medic, regular medic. And then I got back to the medical corps to be a commander. So basically when I was 18, I was training people how to be combat medics.
And who are these people you were training?
It's called Ba'ad Eser. It's the medical corps of Israel. It's the place that, it's basically the school of everything related to medicine.
Do you remember the first time you treated a wounded soldier or civilian?
So that was in that war. In the war of since October 7th happened.
So maybe backtrack. Yeah. So you served your 2 years.
Yes.
You got released from the IDF. Then October 7th happens, and you get called back mm-hmm. on reserve duty. Mm-hmm. So maybe explain that to people. A lot of people will be watching this and they see a young 24, 26-year-old woman and said, well, you served. Why are you back in the IDF?
So basically, when I finished my military, I trained over 160 soldiers to be combat medics. And that was like my biggest achievement in life, to know that I teach so many people how to be medics. But then when we got released from the military, they told us that in time where Israel needs, we will be taking back to be just regular medics and not teachers as we thought we were going to be. And obviously my friends and I were looking at each other and said, okay, but when is it going to happen? There's no way that they're going to take commanders that never treated a soul in their life to go to the battlefield and treat people. But then on October 7th, on the morning of October 7th, 5 hours after the attack, I got a call from my commander, and he told me that we are going to get enlisted and they don't know what our role is going to be. That's a long story short. I was stuck 6 months in the Gaza border treating soldiers, Palestinians, even Hamas terrorists.
So anyone who got funneled.
Yeah.
So yeah, do you remember the first time?
I do. So the first time, obviously, it wasn't just first time treating a person. It was first time in my life seeing blood, because I was only teaching people in theory. I was never really a medic. I never really treated people. So I remember the first time I came. So basically, the way it works in the military, we have an ambulance team, and it's me plus two medics and our paramedic or doctor. So we were there at the border of Gaza, and our ambulance stopped in the meeting point when we got our soldiers that just got injured inside of Gaza. And I see them stepping outside of the Akhzarit,
which is like a armored vehicle.
Yes. And I see them in a gurney and a lot of blood around it. And then I remember myself, I froze. I couldn't really react. I couldn't do anything. And basically, I was the right hand of my paramedic. That was my role within our team. And I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even think. And I remember my paramedic came to me and she was like, wake up, wake up. What are you doing? And then I just went on automatic pilot. And I don't really remember what happened. But I remember that after that incident, I just promised to myself that I can't freeze again.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you don't only treat soldiers, you also treated Palestinian civilians and Hamas terrorists. Before asking you how that's like, I want to ask you maybe a question that I know the answer to, but many people listening or watching would have a much broader question. Why? You're an Israeli medic in the Israeli military.
Yeah.
Why are you even treating non-Israelis?
So when every combat medic or even a regular medic finish their combat medic course, they take an oath, the combat medic oath. Basically on that oath, you're swearing to save every person's life, no matter if it's your loved one or if it's your enemy. And you finish your combat medic course and you're saying that this oath, but you never really expect to be in that exact moment, because you're just saying it because I asked my soldiers to take that oath and they trusted me. There's also an ethic lesson that I remember that I was teaching the soldiers. And whenever we used to talk about these kind of subjects, there was a lot of debate between the class, and everybody couldn't really agree with, nobody could agree with nobody. And when people heard about that lesson, it was a lot of fights between the
what
soldiers.
Was the lesson? Do you remember?
It was basically you're standing there and you're presenting them, you're presenting your soldiers incidents that happened, that soldiers, that medic had to treat terrorists before they had to treat a soldier. And you're asking them, what would you do in that case? And you're showing them that it's basically not about the fact that he is Jewish or that he is a terrorist or that he is Palestinian. It's about what kills first, get treated first. It doesn't matter the ethnicity or where is that person from. And I remember also the first time treating a terrorist, because that's something I will never forget. Because the first time that I got the call, they told us it's going to be a terrorist. Obviously, the first instinct was, what? Why do I have to save him? Leave him there. Why do I have to treat him? But then my paramedic told me something that also stayed with me. She told me, first of all, you took an oath and we are different than them. This is what separates between us and them. We value life more than anything. We value the life of terrorists as we will value the life of a soldier. But more than that, maybe he has information about the hostages. Maybe he has information about this war. We have to save him more than anyone. And I remember kneeling down, and one of the first things you have to do is basically to take off the clothes that your patient is wearing, because you need to see if there's extra bleeding that you can't see. And I remember myself, my hands were shaking while I was cutting his uniforms.
Like, not really uniform, right?
This, yeah.
Is Hamas, yeah.
But I was removing his clothes and I was shaking, because in my mind, these people are so savage that maybe he had an explosive inside of his body that he sewed inside. And that was everything I can think about. And I remember myself cutting everything and searching for stitches, because maybe he has a bomb inside his body. And I've been reeling the clothes, and I see a pink underwear.
Mm.
And my paramedic and I started to burst out of laughter. But then we realized that this is war. We never asked to do this, but we have to do it. And it was just like a reality check that we got. And we just kept doing and treating him until we saved him, obviously, and took him to the doctors. And afterwards, she told me she's proud of me, because I put my emotions aside and I just treated him as a patient.
You know, we talked about this before we started recording, but I also went through combat medic training in the IDF as part of being in the Navy. And I remember that class. I remember those discussions of the ethical question, mm-hmm. right? Because the medic rule, as I recall it, is, you know, there's two rules, first in, first out. So whoever comes first, you treat them first. You don't stop in the middle. Mm-hmm. But the other one is the most dire, the most life-threatening, you deal first. Again, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter if it's Israeli, if it's Palestinian. And I remember the arguments and the lack of agreements. You know, I was doing the course with guys from Golani and Givati and the paratroopers and the Shayetet and everything. And I remember thinking, everyone talks about the IDF being the most moral army. I don't believe there's moral armies, but the fact that we were having these moral conversations was the important thing, even if we didn't agree.
Yeah, exactly. It's we have to talk about it, because at the end of the day, it will happen, and it happens all the time. Israeli medics saving Palestinians' life, saving our enemies, because this is the difference between the IDF and any other military. Because it doesn't matter what life is, because when I see a patient on the floor, blood is blood. I don't ask this patient if it's Israeli, Jewish, Palestinian. Obviously, I can hold a different opinion while treating and saving this patient's life. But it doesn't matter, because the military is really, I really believe that, because I've experienced that and I've seen what happened when somebody says no to treat a terrorist. Mm.
What was it like being a young woman for almost 6 months in reserve duty in this war?
It was hard, because I never thought I'll be in a situation like this. When I was a commander, we slept in rooms. I was teaching in classes. We had air conditioner. We had showers. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself sleeping in a tent with 12 other guys. And it was me and a couple other girls. So basically your entire life is upside down. You brush your teeth in a fountain. You eat cold food. You don't really have anything with you. You only have your uniforms. You don't really get to change them or take a shower or even change your socks at some point, because we are always on call. We're 24 hours on call. And because you don't know when you're going to be called at, so you sleep with your shoes on, you sleep with your vest on, because you have to be ready right at this second.
What is this vest? So again, you and I understand, but not everyone listening in.
So there's, when you're at war, there's two kinds of vests. There is one protective vest. It's a ceramic bulletproof vest. And it's supposed to protect you if, for example, not only from gunshot, but also from shrapnels. But there's also the combat medic vest. So we had to put on two vests whenever we went to the field. Basically, we used to have our vest on, and then we run to the ambulance and put our medic vest on inside the ambulance and our helmet and everything. So when we sleep there in the field, inside the tent, when we get a call, we have to react. We basically have 30 seconds to jump in the ambulance and drive, because it's 30 seconds drive to the Gaza border. And we have to arrive right now. When you get a call, you don't really have 1 second. So you have to keep your shoes on because you don't really have time to tie your laces.
So, you know, as you're telling this, I'm looking at you and I can't stop thinking that you're just a couple of years, not now, but when the war started, just a couple of years older than most Columbia students who are protesting basically in support of the people mm-hmm. that were trying to kill you while you're at the war. And yet you're so calm and reserved while they are being so melodramatic. And were you ever afraid?
From them?
From during these 6 months. Were you
of
ever
course. In... it's terrifying when you hear the explosive and when you hear the gunshot from Gaza, when you see the explosions, it's terrifying. You're afraid because every second you have to run to the bomb shelter, and some moments you don't have enough time because we have 15 seconds. And for example, when we are at the border of Gaza, there is no bomb shelter, so you don't really have a place to run. So there is a saying that we used to say, if the rocket hits, it hits. We don't really have anything to do with it. You can lie on the ground, you cannot, but you have to treat the people. So I feel like it was terrifying. And I remember myself, we don't really have a bathroom in the field when you sleep in tents. So you go to the nature, that's your bathroom. Yeah. And 4 a.m., to go to the bathroom by yourself as a girl, when you hear Arabic and explosions from Gaza, it's the most terrifying experience I had to do. It's now I'm calm because I've been through that, and I know it doesn't really matter, these, sorry for the language, but stupid college students that have zero knowledge about what's going on because they probably have never stepped foot in the Middle East. I'm so calm because I've been through worse, and to compare this to this, it just can't.
And then at some point, you took on another role while you were doing your reserve duty, and you made this video of basically you speaking to the camera saying, do you want to know what it's like being, you know, Miss Israel or Miss Universe? And all of a sudden you are in full combat gear in Gaza envelope, and that video went viral. Tell me about, why did you even start making that video? Why, you know, you're focused on people coming in gurneys, you're treating them, and now you're dealing with that.
Yeah.
Why?
So it was about a week and a half after October 7th, and basically the first month of my reserve service, we were retraining ourselves because it's been 4 years and nobody remember really how to treat anybody because we never treat anybody. So basically we were just fooling around in our base, and some of the guys just told me, hey, weren't you a beauty queen? I thought you're supposed to be bringing world peace.
And because that's what every
that's
beauty
what
queen
every
wants.
Beauty
it's queens
like, I'll wants. Be bring- I want world peace. and it was a joke to us. But then I told him, wait, let's turn it into a video. There's so much hate right now against Israel. Let's show them that beauty queen go to the military. And that was like the first idea. And we had no expectations because obviously we were
in, wait, so in you're making base. in you're making fun of yourself in a way.
Yeah, of course.
Beauty queens go to the military. It's like Barbie puts on mm-hmm. combat fatigues. so but you're okay with that.
Yeah, of
fun.
Course.
Okay.
Because I have this thing. I was a beauty queen. Let's just use it and maybe it will get people to listen to us because as we know, sometimes beauty sell. And so we just used that. It was a funny joke. Mm-hmm. And we had never expected that this will be a really successful video. And I got after this video, thousands of messages from people, from our enemies, even from people from Iran. I got messages, tons of messages from Egypt, from a lot of people around the world. And then we realized we have real power here. We can use that. We can use the platform. We can use my voice. So I basically, my English wasn't the best at the time. It improved a lot, I think.
Your English is great.
but yeah, I couldn't really hold a conversation back then. So basically I had a friend, Yasmin, her name, and she's a native English speaker. So I remember I was telling her things in Hebrew and she wrote them in English. And then I was memorizing things to make videos. And that was the first part of us starting to do advocacy. But then when I had to go to the Gaza border, we had to stop, obviously, because I didn't really have time. So I remember one time we were improvising. You can hear in this video, I think you can hear like the gunshot in the background. And we were improvising because we felt like we had this platform, we had to use it. So while we were in reserve, we also did this advocacy and we just took off from there.
And you said you got a lot of thousands of messages. Do you remember some of those messages?
Yeah, it was basically, thank you for showing us. What Israel is about. Thank you for explaining us. But it was a lot of messages from girls that said thank you for showing that girls can do both. Because I feel like a lot of people don't really understand that women in Israel, women in the IDF, are the same as men. Mm.
Thank you for showing us that women can do both. Were you feeling like that, that women could do both, or were you just doing what came natural? Or
I felt like I was just doing what I had to do. Everybody had to do the same, so it wasn't even something that I was thinking about. I feel like when you're in that moment, when you're doing something like this, you don't really stop for a second to think, oh wait, I'm doing something really meaningful. You just do what you have to do. And I wish I could take a moment and appreciate what I've done there, because it would have been a little bit easier. Because it's hard to, basically, it's hard to know, because some people you can't save. So it's really hard to know that you're there, you're trying your best, but sometimes even your best is not the best.
I think that's part of being Israeli. There was also a moment, of a picture of you that went viral in those very first days.
Yeah.
And I urge everyone to go and look at this picture, because honestly, you look so beautiful and so badass in that picture. I think you're looking just off camera. You're in your military uniform. You're holding your M16 assault rifle. You're sitting on a military vehicle. What was that picture? What happened there?
So basically we got IDF spokesperson unit that came to document the war. And he just wanted to take pictures because the military is really documenting everything that is happening in the war. So he just came to see what the medical corps are looking like in war. And then he recognized me and he told me, the photographer, and he told me, you were Miss Israel.
And so it's the second time someone recognizes you.
And I was really dirty. I hadn't washed my hair for 4 days or something like this. We were basically covered in dust. And then he was like, oh, I have to take a picture of you. I think it could be really nice to show that also Miss Israel is in the military. And the first instinct was like, you're kidding me, right? I haven't took a shower in 4 days. And he told me that it's okay, don't worry. And I remember one of the girls had like a pink Lobelo, which is
a chapstick.
So I just put it all over my face, like I was trying to improvise makeup. And then we did this photo shoot.
There's something interesting about, so I knew about the story behind the pictures. So obviously when you know the story, you realize that this is like the last second improvisation and you're in the middle of something. But if someone doesn't know the story, it looks like you're modeling the IDF. And
I got this comment a lot and from haters.
Right. And that for the reaction from, you know, from the lovers, from the people that get it,
yeah,
is great. Even at times of stress and difficulty, we remind ourselves that we're human. But what's the reaction from the haters on a picture like that, on your videos from there?
So I get a lot of hate, but this picture got tons of hate too. That I was modeling the military, that the military is using women to sell the IDF, that I'm just a pretty face that they just randomly chose and put in uniform, that I didn't really do anything. I was called Miss Genocide. I was crowned actually as Miss Genocide after. A lot of comments about this picture.
What's your reaction to accusations like these?
So at first I was really scared because I was not used to getting so much hate at once. And I remember my mom also got hate because they found her Instagram page and they used to send her messages. She got pictures. They messaged my mom pictures of me in a grave, pictures of me as a dead body, photoshopped. And
So you, because you were being photographed and speaking about Israel in IDF a uniform, your mom got pictures of you.
Yeah, my mom got pictures. And they used to send her also pictures of what happening in Gaza and accusing me of that. And because they can't separate between the two words. And for them, I'm not only an IDF soldier. For them, I'm an IDF soldier. I'm a propaganda machine. And I was Miss Israel. So for them, there's so many things that they can hate me about. Mm-hmm. And after a while of getting this hate, I just realized that if you're getting so much hate, you're probably doing a really good job because you're pissing off so many people. Maybe your message is coming across to some of them, maybe not, but your message is out there.
But getting so much hate can also be very difficult and emotionally taxing. So how do you still deal with that?
I still deal with that. I feel like every single person that is speaking on Israel, that is speaking online about Israel, is getting a lot of hate as well. Now I just laugh about it because it's funny to me.
Laugh about the hate.
We have to look at it, the bright side of things, because to me it's funny that these people are spending so much time and energy trying to make me feel scared or sad. So I have to laugh about it. I have to be positive about it.
And there's another third level to that picture. So it's not just, you know, Miss Israel in uniform. It's not just you being taken from basically the close to the battlefield for a moment to take a picture, but it's also a picture of a female soldier whose three grandparents are Holocaust survivors.
Yeah.
Tell me about your grandparents and how does that feel?
So my grandparents, my grandfather was a partisan. He was fighting the Nazis. My grandmother survived Auschwitz together with two of her sisters. And my other grandmother was born in a ghetto in Libya, in Tripoli. And to me, that's something that I've always looked at my grandparents and was so proud to be their grandchild. And after they passed away, my grandmother and I were very close. And she always told me she was the proudest grandmother, obviously, because her dream was for me to be Miss Israel. And after I won, really the doctors told us that they think it gave her more time because she was really on her last days, and then she survived for another year and then she passed away. And to me, being there with her and making her so proud on her last moments was everything I could ask for. And after I started doing this advocacy, after everything that happened, I remember a sentence that my father told me when he got his wings in the pilot course. My grandfather went obviously to the ceremony and he stood up and he screamed, "This is my win. We won the Nazis. We won." And that sentence obviously was something that lived with him. But he told me afterwards that this is the real win. The fact that you're fighting for Israel as the grandchild of Moshe Kochva and Nili Kochva and Aliza Gerbi, this is the real win, because we are actually doing right now what our ancestor could have never done. So to me, just being their grandchild is one of the biggest things that I could, the biggest thing that I could do in my life is to tell their stories and to make sure that everybody will know about them.
What do you think they would have said to you or about you, about everything that's happening in the past 20 months and what you've been doing?
I'm actually happy, not happy, but I'm happy that my grandmother is not alive, because if she would have been alive seeing that, she could have not survived that. She would have died of a broken heart, because she was so Zionist, and all of my grandparents were very Zionist and they loved Israel so much. And for them, seeing what is happening is the worst thing that could have happened. I hope they're proud of me. My parents tell me this all the time. That
I'm sure they're proud of you.
It's the most important thing. And they're just they left a really big mark on my life. So all I want is for them to look down and be proud.
I can tell you without a doubt, not having known any of your grandparents, that they're extremely proud of you. After the war, you came to the US. Why?
So the first time I came was 5 days after I got released from the military, and I was invited to just go speak with Jewish communities in LA. And in my mind, I thought to myself that could be a nice time to take off a little bit of a vacation after everything I've seen. And I just realized maybe I want to take like a week off, 2 weeks, just to relax after everything that I've seen. And after this week, I was invited to speak again and again. And I just realized how much power and strength my story can bring to people right now that are feeling helpless, that are feeling that they're not doing enough. And that's something that I'm telling all the time, that the Jewish community is doing a lot. And for me, for example, after 2 weeks in the war, I got donations from the Jewish communities of brand new BMW ambulances. And I could have never saved life without these donations. So I just realized how important it is to keep the flame going, to keep the Jewish communities united, to show them, to connect them to Israel. And then after a while, I met an amazing organization named Israel Friends. And I teamed up with them and now I'm their spokesperson. And it got me to move here to America. And the first time that I realized that I need to move here, I say move, but it's a temporary.
It's never a move.
It's never a move. It's a temporary stay in the US because for me, there is no other place to be and to raise my children and to live than Israel. Obviously, my entire family is also in Israel. But I spoke once in I spoke once in a school. It was 12 years old girls. And I just told them my story. And 3 months after, I met one of the children, one of the children's father. And he came up to me and he told me, "You're Miss Israel, right?" And I said, "Yeah, how are you?" And he told me, "I want to say thank you, but not for your Instagram or the stories that you're doing about Israel. I want to say personal thank you because after you spoke with my daughter at her school, she came to me and told me, 'Dad, I met Miss Israel. I want to do Aliyah. I want to be a combat medic like Noah.'" And then it hit me that this is something that I have to keep doing until I will speak to these children and these girls that need to be inspired and I need to hear the real stories about real Israelis.
Wow, that's probably one of the best things that you can hear for someone who comes to tell their story. That someone else wants to be part of your story.
That changed my perspective about this because I'm very Zionist. I want to be in Israel. But then hearing his words to me, I realized that I can actually make a difference here.
I think a lot of people watching this or listening in would take a lot of inspiration from that. But your words don't have to change the world. All they have to do is change one, two, three young people. And
maybe
you never know
where the world.
And yes, you never know where they can take it. Now, of course, your visits to the US have not been all easy and smooth sailing. You mentioned in passing the welcome reception you received in San Francisco. I think it's San Francisco University, State University, where they held you a Miss Genocide contest. What happened there?
So 2 days before I was supposed to arrive to San Francisco, I started getting a lot of threats and people telling me that I'm not going to land in San Francisco. Crazy, crazy messages.
Why?
Because they hated me. They hated what I represent. They told me that I'm representing a war, that I'm doing war crime. I was doing war crimes. I was ethnically planned. That was one of the things that he said about me. I was ethnically cleansing Palestinians in Gaza, but in fact, I saved Palestinians that were injured in Gaza. And they told me that I'm not welcome in San Francisco.
Now, San Francisco is one of the most, if not most progressive cities in the city, if not the world, in the United States, if not the world. Obviously, the place where the first elected gay mayor, who's Jewish, Harvey Milk, feminist movement. They have a strong feminist woman coming to talk about saving lives in a war. They are against war. They are for women empowerment. What is it that you represent that is so heinous to them?
I wish I knew. To them, it was, she's Miss Israel. She was an IDF medic. That's all they needed to hear to hate me. But this is why I laugh about things like this right now, because they don't really know me. They have no idea what is my last name, how to pronounce it. They don't know what I like to eat. They don't know what I like to do. They have no idea the person that I am. All they know is that what I did. And this is why they hate me. So they don't really hate me. They hate the idea of me. So this is one of the things that we really need to remember.
So you landed in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You got to campus. What happened?
So basically, it wasn't in a campus. It was in a synagogue. Mm-hmm. We were meeting the Jewish community there. And they had to change two synagogues before because they knew where we were going to speak. And then when I arrive there, I see a crazy protest. Basically, I see them pouring red buckets of paint all over the staircase. And then they held their entire pageant. They basically did signs and sashes, like pageant sashes, but instead of saying Miss Israel, they said Miss Genocide, Miss Ethnic Cleansing, Miss Information. And they basically did a vote of what title I should get now. And then they crowned me as Miss Genocide, and they brought signs and all of the above. And basically their entire goal was to spread hate.
And that wasn't the only time that you got attacked. What happened in Times Square?
So we were filming here with a few guys that also do advocacy, Moshe and Daniel. And we were
from Let's Do Something.
From Let's Do Something. Right. And we were basically just filming a funny video with Israel flags. And all of a sudden, we had no idea that at the same time, a really big pro-Palestine protest is going to happen. So around 5,000 pro-Palestinians came. And they saw us, obviously, because you can't miss a giant flag in the middle if you hate Israel. And they came to us and they started to tear down our flag. We were a lot of, also after it happened, Daniel, Moshe and I found more Israelis and we joined them because we felt like three people against 5,000. So at that point, we were around 10 guys and me, one girl. And they tore down our flags. One of the guys had a Star of David necklace. They tore it down too. They spit at us. They cursed us. And then all of a sudden, a really tall guy took a pole took a protest sign and just shoved it in my face. I was the only girl there. He could have chose to hit a guy. He could have chose not to hit anybody.
He could have chose to not engage in violence just because you don't agree with someone.
But he chose, and that was the first time that I ever got a black eye. And it was something I will never forget because I remember more than anything, I saw his eyes. He was filled with hate. And once again, this person, not only that he had no idea that I was Miss Israel or that I was an IDF medic, he just knew one thing, that I'm holding a flag of something that represents what he hates. He had no idea who am I. So that's also something that really shook me to my core, because the hate is so, so powerful that they just choose to hate somebody just because he's holding an Israel sign.
But you don't just engage, you know, with the haters. A lot of the content that I've seen you do and we've done together is engaging in conversation with people, trying to educate them. See, there's a lot of videos of you walking around saying, I served in the IDF, I saved Palestinian and Israeli lives, ask me anything. What are some questions that you get? What are some of the misconceptions that that people have about Israel that you can correct sometimes?
A lot. I feel like it's mainly around this subject of the fact that Israel is actually saving people, and how can you call it a genocide when we're actively saving the life of our enemies? So this is a question that all the time people are asking me around that subject. But I really you spoke about doing positive content, and in a crazy times like this, we really need to focus on this type of content, because at the same time, we have a lot of hate, but we also have a lot of love, and we need to take this love, and we need exactly to show them, because the people that did this protest against me and that hit me in my face, also another girl pulled a knife at me because she saw that I'm an IDF soldier.
That was a crazy video, by the way. That was, when I saw that video, I realized this isn't just like regular, unfortunately, regular American violence, which happened a lot, but this is, we're getting to strange.
Yeah, this is pure anti-Semitism. And when we see all the things that they're doing, they're basically spreading hate all the time. Every action that they're choosing to do, they're spreading hate, and they're naming it fight for peace, but they're spreading hate. So we need to show everybody that we are fighting for peace too, but we are fighting for peace with love, with positivity, with kindness. And that's one of the things that, this is why I really love to engage in conversations, because even when you're engaging somebody in conversations, you don't have to yell at him. And when we were filming this video, we weren't yelling at people. We weren't making arguments with people. We just spoke with them. We just wanted to really communicate with people because nobody will listen to you if you will scream at him.
Right. And the one thing that I would say, but I disagree with what you said because I agree with almost everything. The two words you never hear at Columbia in protests are peace or coexistence.
Yeah.
Those are two words that they never say because they don't want peace or coexistence. They want only one existence of one specific group. Whereas people like you and I, when we find ourselves like, wait, I thought we're on the same side. We are all wanting peace and coexistence. Unfortunately, the organizers, at least, of these actions are not.
Peace for one side.
Peace for one side. I want to ask you about the conversations we had right before we started filming, trying to explain to the world something about the Israeli mentality. And specifically, it's about a video you made last night. So just for context for when this comes out, a few days ago, Israel finally struck the nuclear weaponry in Iran. Iran retaliated, I guess, by targeting Israeli population, Israeli civilians. In the past few days, 24 Israelis have lost their lives, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, due to these missiles. But then you recorded a video saying, all I want to do right now is go back to Israel.
Yeah.
Let me say it in the most blunt way that someone listening in would say is like, what the fuck? Why would you make a video, I want to go into a war zone?
And I will say it again. All I want to do right now is to be in Israel, even if it means to sit in a bomb shelter with my family. It's something that I feel like a lot of Israelis, you as well, would agree, because when something is happening in Israel, you feel it because your heart feels it. You feel it all over your body. And you need to be there because this is your homeland, because it's something that is really special about Israelis. We've experienced so much trauma together, and it just binds us to this beautiful, not beautiful, but just it's something that even words can't explain, because we've experienced really the most crazy things that anyone can experience, but we did it together. We did it standing together, and after October 7th, the Israelis just stood up together. And this togetherness, if it's a word, this togetherness of being together in Israel, feeling everything. And right now, obviously, you wake up and you get the news from far, but it's not the same as being there. And even if you can't do anything, even if you're just in a bomb shelter, it just means to stand there on the land of Israel and being with your people, being with your community. And it's just something that I can't explain. And that's all I want to do, especially now my friends are getting back to reserve. And all I want to do is not only be in Israel, but go back to my friends in my unit. I want to serve again. I want to be there. I want to help, because being Israeli doesn't just mean, oh, we have a funny accent and we eat crazy food. Being Israeli means to whenever something is happening in Israel, all you want to do is stop your life and go to Israel and help and do whatever you can, because we were raised on the values of saving Israel, going to the military, protecting your country. It's the country that we are fighting so much to keep. So there is no other way.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the worst thing in the world right now is being stuck in Israel. And the second worst thing is being stuck outside of Israel. Yeah. How are your family doing?
They're typical Israeli family that wants to leave the bomb shelter, and I'm fighting with them to stay in the bomb shelter. They are okay because they've gotten used to it. Not an okay thing to say, but this is the reality. Israelis have gotten used to run into bomb shelter and then to move on with their life like nothing happened. But this time it's different. Mm. this time is.
I want to give a shout out to your mom. What's your mom's name?
Yael.
Yeah, to Yael
Kochva. The best mom in Kochva. The world. Yes.
I want to give a shout out to Yael Kochva because I asked you before we recorded, you know, when you started modeling, and you said, "No, I don't model. I never modeled." Tell me the story of how you became Miss Israel and the candidate for Miss Universe.
So basically, as we said in the beginning, when I got released from the military, I went to study. I was a pastry chef. I went to culinary school, and then I was working in bakeries. I was selling cakes from my house. And then COVID, we had COVID in Israel. It was a lockdown. Then when it cooled down a little bit, me and my ex broke up. And I was devastated. I was lying in bed, crying, eating ice cream, looking at pictures. And my mom decided that she's going to put an end on it. And she just signed me behind my back to Miss Israel competition because she thought that it could just make me happy.
Have you ever been in competitions,
never.
Beauty competitions?
I've never been in beauty pageant competitions. I've never even thought about becoming a model. All I could think about was, oh, I need to study. When I was growing up, I took biology, history, Bible, AP lessons just for fun. I was not even thinking that I can do something related to this because I never really thought I was pretty or never really, it wasn't something that I thought about. And she decided to sign me behind my back. And the first reaction was basically me telling her, there is no way I'm going to pass the first audition. And she told me I need to try because who knows what doors it can open in the futures for me. And I went there for the first audition. In my mind, I'm going to prove my mom that there's no way. And she proved me wrong eventually.
So your first beauty pageant was Miss Israel and you won. So the Jewish people owes Yael Kochva a lot of gratitude.
Yeah, it's
a lot of debt.
I told her also because after October 7th and everything that happened, I told her, thank you for signing me to Miss Israel. But not because I'm Miss Israel now. Couldn't care less, to be honest. Because I got this platform, I got this voice, and I can use that voice now to help and to do more good things with it. So in reconnection to God, I realized that he put me in this situation only so I can be here and inspire other people.
What's next for you?
It's a good question. It's hard to think on the future when so many things are happening in the present. I guess time will tell.
All right. Well, I'll wait to see. We're going to end the episode like we always do with what we call the Here I Am Lightning Round, a series of rapid fire questions. No right or wrong answers. Just the first thing that comes to mind. Noa Kochva.
Yes.
What is one thing people don't know about you?
Ooh, one thing people don't know about me? I was very shy when I grew up. I couldn't even speak to people. I had a really bad social anxiety that I was able to overcome.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Ooh, about the Jews? Can I say about Tripoli Jews?
We yeah,
have
of
the
course.
Best food in the entire world.
Tripoli Jews. Yeah. And a lot of people don't know where Tripoli is. So.
Oh, it's in Libya. My grandmother was born in Tripoli. And basically, best food ever. I can... send recipes after.
All right. What is your favorite curse?
Curse.
Hebrew, English, Libyan, Ladino.
So I don't like curse, actually. I hate to curse. It's going to sound like too much of a goody-good girl, but I really don't curse.
Really? Okay. So when was the last time you cried?
Yesterday, today in the morning, all the time.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
I think Ben Gurion. I love this guy.
You know, an interesting thing. We never heard Ben Gurion until season 5. You're the third person in season 5
really?
To mention Ben Gurion.
Wow.
That's an interesting thing. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Purim.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
When do you feel safest?
Yeah. When do I feel safest? In my childhood home, in Bnei Atarot.
When do you feel least safe?
Least safe. In the streets of New York.
Yeah, so you mentioned feeling unsafe in the streets of New York. What is it? You know, a lot of people will be looking around and saying, what is she complaining about? What are all the Jews complaining about? Tell someone maybe who's not Jewish, or maybe someone who's Jewish and not in New York. What do you feel?
It's just that kind of fear, because you see all of the hate we're getting online, and you see all the hate crimes that are happening in the US and around America, and you can never know when is it going to be you, because it can be you as it can be any other person. And especially when we are very proud, when you speak up on social media. I was recognized a few times in New York from people that hate us. They cursed me. They didn't do anything physical, but you can never know when it's a very thin line between social media hate and real life hate. And Jews around the world are not feeling safe anymore to walk around with. I walk around with my Star of David. But it just.
So why do you walk around with your Star of David if you're not feeling safe? Hide.
We can't hide, because if we're going to hide our Star of David, then it brings us back to the days before, to the days in Germany. And I can never do that as the proud daughter of Holocaust survivors. And I'm always going to be proud, no matter if I'm going to be scared. Of course, I'm going to be scared, but it doesn't mean that we are going to hide ourselves, because the whole point is you can be afraid. It's okay. It's actually you're actually taking concussions.
No. Precautions.
Precautions. you're trying to be safe by being afraid and being aware and looking to your right, looking to your left. But it doesn't mean that it's going to stop us from being proud. Mm. It's just a feeling that you know that there's so much hate right now for the Jewish communities.
One thing that I want to say, which is amazing, your English. You said that before the war, you didn't really speak at all. So your friend Yasmin is a great teacher.
She's an amazing teacher.
But it's incredible, I have to say. What gives you hope?
Seeing people speak up. Seeing people, not even people that are famous, seeing random people speaking up, seeing people wearing hostages being... Seeing people not ignoring the fact that Israel is in the worst war that we've ever experienced. Because to me, as an Israeli that grew up in Israel, I had no idea that so many people abroad love Israel, but not just love Israel because they love to go to Tel Aviv to the beach. They feel a deep connection to Israel. And that gives me so much hope to know that no matter what, we always have the Jewish communities back.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
So I'm working with Israel Friends. They are basically a nonprofit. They started themselves after October 7th, and they have been delivering critical aid to soldiers at the front line, and I really love everything that they're doing.
Where can people find you?
On Instagram, on Twitter. I actually started being active on Twitter. It's a crazy platform. I don't recommend.
I don't recommend it, but we all should be there anyway.
Yeah.
So Noah Kochva is NoaCoch.
VA.
VA. Yeah. Noah Kochva. And that's your name on Twitter and on Instagram. Well, I am so happy that we made this work and you're here. I hope everyone in your family stays safe. I hope that you and I are able to go back to Israel as soon as possible, even just to be there with them. I'm just happy to say, here I am with Noah Kochva.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."